Now, I don't know if you've noticed, and perhaps you probably have in your own life, as well as we've looked into the scriptures, but there is a little bit of a paradox to the Christian life, or to the life of God's people, right? We see this in the Psalms. You know, we read one psalm where it says, like, you know, "You, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head." That God is, you know, he is perfectly able and perfectly consistent in caring and protecting and guiding my life. And then you read a psalm or two later, and it's, "How long, O Lord, will the wicked prosper? How long will you forget me? Will you forget me forever? Will you hide your face from me forever?" And we see this paradox of in the life of God's people, where at one hand, it's, you know, God who is providing and caring and upholding his people, and at the other hand, bad things happen. And today we're going to be discussing not why bad things happen to good people, but why do bad things happen to God's people? Why does he allow bad things to happen to those who he calls his children? And it's going to be an insufficient answer. We're going to go into one particular aspect of it, and we're not going to reach everything, but we are going to be talking about one aspect: why God allows bad things happen to his people, those whom he's called his own. And if you would, turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 12. It's on page 973, if you have one of the guest Bibles that are in the back. And by the way, if you don't have a Bible, you're welcome to pick one of those up and even keep it. If you don't have a Bible, feel free. But Hebrews chapter 12, and we're going to be starting at verse 5. So, verse 5. "Have you forgotten the encouraging words God spoke to you as his children? He said, 'My child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. Don't give up when he corrects you, for the Lord disciplines those whom he loves. He punishes each one he accepts as his child.'" Verse 7, "As you endure this divine discipline, remember that God is treating you as his own children. Whoever heard of a child who's never disciplined by its father? If God doesn't discipline you as he does all his children, it means that you are illegitimate and are not really his children at all. And since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we submit even more to the discipline of the Father of our spirits and live forever? For our earthly fathers disciplined us for a few years, doing the best that they knew how, but God's discipline is always good for us, so that we might share in his holiness. And no discipline is enjoyable while it's happening. It's painful. But afterwards, there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way." So what are we talking about here? After his discussion, as we heard last week about the race of faith that we're on, immediately the author of Hebrews goes into this talk about divine discipline. And as we listen to his words, one thing that is an all too easy mistake that we may make is that when we hear the word discipline, what we hear is punishment. And it's not helped by the fact that he begins with this quote from the book of Proverbs, which associates the discipline of God with his punishment. But think about discipline and punishment as, like, you know, a big Venn diagram, right? So, like, with big overlapping circles. And so some discipline is also punishment, and punishment is also discipline, but there's some punishment that is not discipline, and there's some discipline that's not punishment. Does that make sense? All right, we're tracking, right? And there's this big Venn diagram, big overlap between discipline and punishment. And the author of Hebrews wants to emphasize the discipline and not the punishment. Right? He's saying, you're going through a divine discipline. And what is this discipline? Well, he talks about in chapter 10. Those who, were exposed to public ridicule, he says. They were beaten. They were thrown in jail. They had all that they possessed plundered. They had their houses stripped from them, not for their sin, but for their faithfulness. Not for them turning their backs to God, but because they turned their face towards him. Because they followed Jesus, they were going through persecution, ridicule, beatings, jail, and the theft of their property. And he says, you've accepted it with joy, knowing that there's better things ahead of you. This is part of God's discipline for his people. And whereas we would, you know, hearing about the, you know, other Christians enduring such a thing, what we would probably do is say, oh, poor you. What a horrible outcome. What a horrible thing must be happening to you. I can't even imagine. That's how my response would be. But what does the author of Hebrews say? He says, hear the word of the Lord, the encouraging word of the Lord. The Lord disciplines those he loves. And why is it not, and he goes on, and as he, you know, he quotes the thing from Proverbs where he, you know, discipline is associated with punishment, but then he drops the punishment languages and focuses on discipline. Even as we reach verse 11, where he says, you know, you've been trained in this way. And what that word trained is the word gymnasio or gymnazo, which we get gymnasium from. It's this athletic metaphor, right? He's carrying on the, when he's talking about the race that they've been running with faith, well, guess what? They're being trained by the divine discipline of God. Right. And so what is discipline? Discipline is helping somebody choose the right thing rather than the now thing. Right? If you're disciplined on your diet and somebody brings in donuts to work and you say, no, I need to keep my calories low, well, that is being disciplined. You're denying the immediate thing, the right now thing, for the goal. Right? If you're wanting to work out and your alarm goes off in the morning and you don't want to wake up, but you do it anyway, well, that is being a disciplined person, because the right now thing is I want to sleep and I don't want to get up to work out. And if that's what you want to be, life hack right now, we set our clocks an hour back, just pretend like it was yesterday, and then you have an extra hour in the morning, and everything's fine, right? So, but that's what a disciplined person is, I'm going to deny the right now thing for the better thing, for the better goal, the thing that I'm working towards that is better. And so by nature, all of us want to be disciplined people. All of us, right? Who doesn't want to be able to deny themselves in the moment in order to achieve the goal that they want long term? That doesn't mean we're all good at doing it, but all of us would want to. And also by nature, none of us want to be disciplined. None of us, you know, as the author of Hebrews says, you know, it's painful. It stinks when you're going through it, but it produces results. But so when God disciplines, it's to make somebody who is disciplined, someone who's able to deny the things that they want in the moment, to endure those things, or to endure or deny the things that they want right then and right now for the long-term goal. And so some discipline that God does is punishment, and some of it's not. Some discipline is just the by the very nature that we live in God's moral world, right? So we get what we deserve. Like, I decide I'm going to hit my snooze alarm 37 times, and then I'm late for work, and I do that every day, and then so I get fired, and I have to deal with financial hardship, right? And no one is, you know, I mean, that is, in some level, divine discipline, because what? We are receiving exactly what we did through our foolishness and sin. Other discipline is, you know, God does it, where it's not necessarily an easy cause and effect from our actions, right? So like, and this is apropos for this Communion Sunday morning, like when in 1 Corinthians 11, when Paul talks about those who are taking communion unworthily, what does he say is happening to them? They're getting sick. Some are even dying, right? It is God acting in a way that brings discipline upon his people for doing that which is not right. That is punishment, but also discipline. But some discipline is also It's to build character for the journey. That is not necessarily reflected because there's a particular sin or foolishness in your life. And this is at some level what the author of Hebrews is talking about here, right? Those people who are suffering for what they have, you know, for their faithfulness and not for their unfaithfulness. We remember one of the most famous passages in the scripture, Psalm 23, of the shepherd who leads us on paths of righteousness. And then the next line, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I know you're with me. That the valley of the shadow of death, those two are paths of righteousness. Those two are where the shepherd leads. And that too brings discipline for his people. And so as we come to the scriptures, we have a very different idea of, well, how to deal with hardships in our lives than the rest of the world does. And what we see throughout the whole New Testament is that in our hardships, in our trials, in our discipline, whether it's for punishment or whether it's just for training, what we see is the response of God's people is what? Rejoice. Rejoice. That the apostles who were beaten for preaching Jesus, what did they do? They rejoiced for the worthiness of being able to suffer dishonor for the name of Christ. Or as James writes to his people that, you know, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Or Paul, when he's writing, he's like, not only that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And how different it is that the believer to view life's circumstances when they're unfavorable as marks of joy for what God is doing. How much does that set us apart from the rest of the world who, when we look at our trials and look at the things that we experience, well, what do we go to? Well, we go to complaining and bitterness and anger. But not for you. Not for you as the people of God, the children of God. As we endure, what do? We rejoice. Now, if you've been following the news, I know you've perhaps heard that, you know, the big election in Virginia, and one of the things that came out of that, or one of the parts where people were debating about and complaining about and stuff, was this idea of what they call critical race theory being taught in schools. And some people, you know, look at that and they say, well, you know, that's not being taught in schools, or that all it is teaching kids about racism, and in which case, you know, nobody has a complaint about that. But critical race theory comes from what's called critical theory. That goes back to, a little bit after World War I. You see, Karl Marx, as he was, writing the Communist Manifesto, and he basically viewed the world, and I know this is a simplistic analysis, but it viewed the world as, you have the oppressed and the oppressor, the victim and the perpetrator, the bourgeois and the proletariat. And in his view, he viewed, all of history, all of human government going towards what he would call, you know, a communist form of government, where those who were oppressed, those who were victims, those who were, part of the underclass, they would rise up, throw off their shackles, and form a more just society. And he prophesied, as much as an atheist can, that there was going to be a great war. And after the Great War, that's when the masses would rise up. But there's a problem. There was a Great War, and the masses didn't rise up. After World War I, you know, the capitalist Europe continued on. The only people who rose up was feudal Russia. And so the intellectuals of the day, they wanted to figure out, why? Why didn't we rise up? Why didn't we make a more just society? And they came up with the solution, the idea, where the people are blinded by the wealth of the system, that they can't recognize their oppression. They're blinded by wealth and prosperity and, you know, little things like having food, where they wouldn't necessarily recognize that they're actually part of the oppressed, the marginalized, the underclass. And so they continued on and said, well, how do we change that? And they came up with the idea of critical theory. And what does it mean? What is the practice? Well, it's pretty simple. You criticize everything. Do you need a solution? No, you don't need a solution. You just criticize again and again and again in order to waken people up from the blindness of their own lies, that they wouldn't be content with what they have. They would recognize that they're oppressed, that they're victims, that they're part of the proletariat and not the bourgeoisie. And they would continue on. And critical theory has been employed for decades, I think close to a century, or over a century at this point. And most people who are participating in it have no idea. They haven't read Marx or Hegel or any of the writers of, you know, Saul Alinsky or the people from the Frankfurt School. They have no idea. But that's the beauty of the idea, is that you don't need them to read it, realize it. You just need to stir in people this idea of a discontentment with the way things are. And for a century, this has been employed in the Western part of the hemisphere. And we see this, and the reason I'm talking about this is not necessarily to, you know, to bash on communism or anything like that. The reason I say this is because it produces a work sociologically within the people of a culture. That when you view the world simplistically, as the oppressed and the oppressor, the victim and the perpetrator, the bourgeois and the proletariat, and that in order to be part of the good guys, I need to not be part of those guys. In order to increase my goodness, I have to increase the ability or the amount with which I am oppressed and a victim. I have to emphasize that. And for many people, there is this implicit idea that the more angry I am, the more bitter I am, the more frustrated I am at the system, proves that I'm part of the moral, oppressed, victim class. And so there's this draw to the people within this culture, and even to the people of God, that as we go through suffering, as we go through trials, as we go through, whatever we have to deal with, it is not a time for rejoicing in the faithfulness of God. No, no, no. It's a time for complaining and building up my victim credentials. As the author of Hebrews is writing to these people who are, you know, by the state being oppressed and ridiculed and thrown into jail and having their things plundered, he's not saying, oh, you poor people. He's saying, no, this is time for rejoicing. This is the discipline of God, who is firming you up for the journey ahead. And what should we rejoice in? What should we rejoice in when we receive the Lord's discipline? Well, there's a few things. In God's discipline, I rejoice in the Father's affirmation. I rejoice in the Father's affirmation. What does he say in starting at verse 7? Let's reread that. As you endure this divine discipline, remember, God is treating you as his own children. Whoever heard of a child who's not disciplined by its father? If God doesn't discipline you as he does for all his children, it means you're illegitimate. You're not really children at all. And since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we submit even more to the discipline of our Father of spirits and live forever? Implicitly, the author of Hebrews is making this distinction that was known in the Greco-Roman world. So the legitimate child, you know, the child through the wife would receive training and instruction. Now, if the father was promiscuous and had children with other women or prostitutes or slaves, those were not considered legitimate children. They would receive no training, no discipline, nothing from the father. It was only for legitimate children that receive the training. And what is the author of Hebrews saying? He's saying, when you receive divine discipline, what you're receiving is the Father's affirmation of who you are in Him. You truly are a son. You truly are a daughter. You are not, you know, when you have been purchased by Christ and adopted in Christ, you are truly a true son and a true daughter. You are not an illegitimate one that God doesn't really care about. And we can rejoice in God's discipline. And I want to be very careful with my language here. That Jesus too received the Father's discipline. Not punishment. Well, punishment on our behalf. Punishment for what we did. But even beyond that, He received the Father's discipline. As the author of Hebrews says earlier, he says that Jesus learned obedience through His suffering. That there was some level, at some way, that the one who never disobeyed the Father, who was with Him in perfect love from eternity past, yet was still had to learn the fullness of obedience in a way that He could not do living in heaven with God. That some level of His obedience needed to be learned through suffering, when it cost Him something, when it pained Him in order to follow the will of the Father. That the Son, Jesus, too, had to learn obedience. And so what we hear is this word from God, that when God disciplines you, He's not treating you any different than He did His own Son, Jesus. He's not treating you differently. You are a legitimate child as you go through suffering and pain. It's not only do I rejoice in the Father's affirmation, but I also rejoice in the Father's formation. That God is accomplishing something within His divine discipline. That God's discipline doesn't reveal His failure to work, but it reveals that He is working in your life. Now, as one of the, I don't know if this will make you more excited or less excited, but, you know, on your seats with the communication cards, and as you write down prayer requests, and we pray for them on Tuesday mornings as a staff, one of the things that I almost always pray for every single need that comes across is that you, or the person that you're lifting up for prayer, is going to have, that God's grace would reach them, that would reveal His working in their life where they are. Yes, I'll pray for healing. Yes, I'll pray for resolution of the situations. But the first and the primary and the emphasis of my prayers for you is that in your suffering, that you see the grace of God at work. That you see that He has not abandoned you. He has not left you. And He's wanting to do something in this situation for you on your behalf. That He is creating a discipline, trying to discipline His people through this situation. To cause them to live for the ultimate thing rather than the now thing. So what does He say, verse 10? Our earthly fathers disciplined us for a few years, doing the best that they knew how. But God's discipline is always good for us, so that we might share in His holiness. So no discipline is enjoyable while it's happening. It's painful, but afterwards there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way. Right? That God is training His people for this race. He's creating in His people something here. Now, one of the things that I do and probably spend too much time doing is as I watch lots of different athletes on YouTube. And I've noticed the very different ways that athletes train for whatever sport they're involved in. Right? So like, I have watched a professional rock climber who, when he goes to the gym, he does endless amounts of pull-ups and, you know, pulling motions, working the back and the lats and the traps. And he does very little in terms of going to bench or squat or do any of those things. In contrast, you know, the power lifter is going to pretty much go and do three lifts, right? The squat, the bench, and the deadlift. And he's going to go really heavy, really often. And in contrast to that, you have the track athlete who, you know, does really lightweight but really explosive and all these things. And all these, you know, depending on what sport they're involved in, they train completely differently. And why do they do that? Well, for a few reasons. The first is that they want to train them in a specific way to get better at their specific goals and tasks. And every moment that they spend training in one way is taking away from the time that they could be training in a way that's more specific. And also, training in, you know, if like the rock climber goes and he trains like a power lifter and, you know, makes, you know, gets huge chest muscles and leg muscles and puts on like 25 pounds of muscles in his chest and his legs, well, what's that going to do? Every time he has to pull himself up, the hundreds of times he has to pull himself up to get up the mountain, he has to pull an extra 25 pounds each time. And the rock climber's not going to say there's anything wrong, there's anything bad about, you know, benching or squatting or anything. He's like, but it's not going to get me to the task that I want to do. It's going to be a hindrance because it's adding extra weight that I have to pull. So for the past couple weeks, Pastor Sean has been talking about this, hasn't he? That there's lots of things in the Christian life that aren't bad in themselves, but they're extra weight. And as God is training his people, it teaches us the centermost essence of the things that we need training with, doesn't he? That there are some things that aren't bad in themselves, just as bench pressing isn't bad, but for the rock climber, it's not helpful for getting his goals. And there's lots of things in our lives that aren't necessarily bad, yet they're not helpful, are they? They don't help us reach the end with faithfulness. And what we see in the divine discipline of God, that if we have eyes to see it, if we believe he's working, if we are convinced that in my pain and suffering, that he is wanting to purify us in a ways that, in a focused way, that we can reach the goal that he set out for us. What might some of those things be? That he exposes as the love for man's approval, as people suffer ridicule and open shame before them. The love for comfort, as his people are enduring things like sickness, beatings, imprisonment. The love for entertainment. What are the things that captivate our heart? That in all the workings of God, he's, if we let him, if we're willing to agree with the scriptures and say that God is at work here, looking to produce in me holiness, we're going to see that we've been carrying some dead weight. Things that aren't helping us very much, are we? So in discipline, I see the Father's affirmation of who I am. I see the Father's formation in creating me holy, but I also see the Father's intention. Don't miss that line. The Father's intention is always good, he says. Now, as a young kid, I think most of us, as we had been disciplined, and at some level, our kids can very oftentimes, you know, view us, well, until they reach like pre-teenage, view us as people who make the right decisions, and, you know, our anger is always justified, and we always discipline in the right way. And as a parent, I realize that's not how I would characterize myself. And I'm surprised that my kids had, you know, when I've had to apologize for the way I've conducted myself, and they were kind of like surprised, like, oh, why would you apologize? But what we see, you know, as parents, you know, we try to discipline in the right way, to produce a kid who's going to do the right thing rather than the right now thing. And oftentimes, perhaps, you know, we skew far more towards punishment than discipline in our anger and frustration. But isn't it a good thing that as the people of God, that when the Father disciplines us, he's not prone to such mistakes. He's not prone to wasted suffering or full-vented anger. That for his children, his goal is to produce righteousness in us and holiness in us. That we can be people who finish the race and not succumb to the right now things. And how tragic is it for those in the faith who served faithfully for years, but then gave themselves up to the trappings of the right now? How much shame has the church experienced as big name pastors and leaders and speakers succumbed to such a thing? How good is it when the Father disciplines us and teaches us to follow on the journey until the end? So my hope for you and my prayer for you is that in your hardships, your heart would be awakened to the grace of God. That you would be affirmed where you are as God's child. That you would realize that the punishment is not I'm mad at you, you're not my child, you're on the side, but it is the affirmation that you truly are a child of God. That your eyes would be open to his transforming work at work in you. That you would not give in to bitterness and anger and despair so prevalent in our age. But you would be strengthened by the hope of the age to come, giving all glory to the Father, Son, and Spirit. This is my prayer for you.